Today is April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up, the long-awaited government report on Russian election meddling has been released, but some think it does not completely clear U.S. President Donald Trump of wrongdoing.
I'm not sure that the findings constitute a victory for the president, but those claims run contrary both to the facts in regard to the effectiveness of Russian interventions and as to the depth and extent of the obstruction efforts by the White House from the president on down.
Also ahead, a story on the use of social media in Sudan, the latest on the election in Indonesia, and a look at religious observances of Passover and Good Friday. It's all on International Edition. After 22 months of investigations, Americans in Congress got to see most of the report of Special Counsel Robert Mueller into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. The report found no evidence of a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia, but Mueller and his team could not make a judgment on whether the president sought to hinder his investigation. Opposition Democrats say they will push for additional investigations in Congress. Today, New York Congressman Jerry Nadler issued an order in an effort to get the full report from the Justice Department. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports on early reaction to the report in Washington.
At the White House, President Donald Trump was upbeat after the release of the Mueller report.
I'm having a good day, too. It was called No Collusion, No Obstruction. I'm having a good day. There never was, by the way, and there never will be.
But the report paints a different picture on the question of obstruction of justice, detailing numerous instances when the president sought to influence the investigation. At one point, Trump ordered then White House lawyer Don McGahn to have special counsel Robert Mueller fired, says Chad Day of the Associated Press.
Now, McGahn rebuffed this effort, but it shows how the president, and the report quotes him, saw the probe as a possible end to his presidency and, you know, something that would threaten his power.
The report describes numerous contacts between Trump campaign associates and Russians in 2016. But concluded there was a lack of evidence of a criminal conspiracy between the campaign and Russia. But Mueller did not make a judgment on whether the president sought to obstruct justice. The report did not conclude that Trump committed a crime, but neither did it exonerate him. In the end, it was Attorney General William Barr who decided that the evidence of obstruction did not warrant further legal action.
Apart from whether the acts were obstructive, this evidence of non-corrupt motives weighs heavily against any allegation that the president had a corrupt intent to obstruct the investigation.
Democrats were troubled by the detailed accounts of possible presidential obstruction and quickly vowed to investigate further, including House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler.
The special counsel made clear that he did not exonerate the president, and the responsibility now falls to Congress to hold the president accountable for his actions. Congress must get the full, unredacted report along with the underlying evidence uncovered by Special Counsel Mueller.
The lingering questions over presidential obstruction could continue to cast a cloud over the Trump White House, says legal analyst David Abraham.
I'm not sure that the findings constitute a victory for the president, but those claims run contrary both to the facts in regard to the effectiveness of Russian interventions and as to the depth and extent of the obstruction efforts by the White House from the president on down.
The ongoing controversy over the Mueller report makes it likely that the legal and political debate over Trump's actions will drag on indefinitely, says political expert Bill Sweeney.
If this goes on for weeks and months, it will be another divisive issue within a country that is already very strongly divided.
Attorney General Barr has been asked to testify before Congress next month, and Democrats also want to hear from Special Counsel Mueller himself in the near future. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Social media has played an important role in the unfolding events in Sudan. Ousted President Omar al-Bashir and his government restricted popular social media platforms during protests against his government. But millions of Sudanese found ways to get around the restrictions to influence others to protest peacefully. VOA's Ayen Bior has this report about the impact of social media on events in Sudan.
On the night of April 8th, just 3 days before Omar al-Bashir would be deposed, Sudanese native Sarah al-Hassan had her eyes glued to Facebook and Twitter. Live videos from Khartoum were streaming onto her computer screen in her home in Phoenix, Arizona, and information was flowing through her Twitter timeline. Social media was the most effective way for her to connect with fast-moving developments back home. She says it kept Sudanese in and out of the country connected, but it also kept them safe and informed.
I don't think this revolution would have happened without social media, in my personal opinion. It's been an integral part of the resistance movement.
NetBlocks.org, a social media monitoring platform, reported during the course of Sudan's revolution that social media platforms were continuously blocked in Sudan, even as the protests intensified. Users, however, used VPN circumvention tools to defy the ban. Last Thursday, NetBlocks reported that Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and other social media platforms were fully restored the same day that the military announced al-Bashir's ouster. Social media proved to be crucial because the state had a tight grip on local media and freedom of the press was restricted, according to some local journalists. With a ranking of 175 out of 180, Sudan is one of the least free countries in this year's World Press Freedom Index. Reporters Without Borders, who publishes the index, says journalists and media were among the leading victims of the crackdown during anti-government protests since December. Alawiya Mukhtar, a journalist in Sudan, says the former regime's repression of the press meant that journalists like herself had to find alternative ways to receive and disseminate information.
Of course, the social media played very big role in the Sudanese uprising revolution because the Sudan main media were blocked to report about the protests. Even the international media were not allowed to report.
Translations from Arabic was also done in real time by native Arabic speakers on Twitter and Facebook in order to share developments to a wider audience. Sudanese translators for change translated tweets and Facebook posts to inform organizers and the world at large. Social media was also used to combat fake news or misinformation, according to Ismail Kushkush, a Sudanese reporter and former acting East Africa bureau chief of the New York Times. He says this time it was also used for security purposes.
It used to be that many activists would approach the usage of social media without paying much attention to the importance of security. And that's how many were tracked down, and many of the protests and demonstrations in previous years were countered by government security. At this time, there was greater attention to the importance of maintaining security.
For the past week, since the military announced the end of al-Bashir's rule, many Sudanese have said they are already enjoying greater freedoms, including freedom of expression. But the fight for a free and inclusive Sudan continues, according to al-Hassan, who says the revolution is not just about ousting the government. It is about completely overhauling Sudanese society. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
Leaders of Sudan's continuing protests in the capital Khartoum are putting pressure on the transitional military council that replaced ousted former President Bashir. The protesters announced plans to form their own civilian council to force Sudan's military to give up power. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum that thousands more protesters joined an ongoing sit-in Friday outside the Sudan Defense Ministry. The main protest group, The Sudanese Professionals Association has said it would form a civilian council to replace the military one. Yesterday, the group issued a written statement saying nominees would be announced soon. The statement added that a civilian presidential council would be formed and a transitional legislative council would include 40% women. Among the top stories in the world, in Paris, French police say they think it is likely an electrical short circuit may have caused the fire that severely damaged Notre Dame Cathedral. In Mali, the prime minister and government have resigned after a massacre of 160 Fulani herdsmen. And a weeks-long voting in India's general election continues as Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Congress Party faces a challenge from the BJP. Expanded coverage of these stories and many more are on VOA's website. This is International Edition. Indonesia, retired military general Prabowo Subianto is claiming victory in the presidential election, although early vote counts do not support his claim. Subianto declared himself the winner to reporters yesterday, claiming he won 62% of the vote. But early results from polling agencies suggest incumbent Indonesian President Joko Widodo is leading with at least 53% of the vote. A spokesperson for Subianto's campaign said the candidate is planning to appeal to Indonesia's constitutional court if the official vote count is different from his own numbers. Official results will be released by the General Election Commission, or KPU, on May 22nd. The chairman of the KPU said the presidential and legislative elections have been overseen by many independent observers and are transparent. He asked that people wait for the official results. VOA's International Edition continues.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
This weekend is an important one for followers of two major world religions. Friday marks the beginning of the Jewish observance of Passover, a yearly festival to mark the Jewish people's release from Egypt as told in the Bible's Old Testament. Christians are observing Good Friday, marking the crucifixion of Jesus. Robert Berger reports for VOA in Jerusalem as worshipers carried out an ancient Holy Land tradition.
Jerusalem was awash with thousands of pilgrims marching through the narrow cobblestone alleyways of the Via Dolorosa, or Way of Sorrows, in Jerusalem's old city. Some carried big wooden crosses on their shoulders. They sang hymns and read scriptures during the traditional Good Friday procession, retracing the path of Jesus to the 14 stations of the cross. The faithful came from all over the world, Frank Caldwell is from Minnesota in the United States.
Well, I think it's always a feeling of walking in the footsteps of Jesus, and it's a very religious feeling and a very good feeling to be here.
Israeli police and soldiers armed with assault rifles guarded the route, but the atmosphere was calm.
We feel very safe here. We certainly don't feel in any fear or that we're the targets of any kind of terrorism or violence.
Good Friday coincides with the biblical Jewish holiday of Passover this year, and Israelis also flocked to Jerusalem to celebrate. Among them was Eddie Stern.
Passover is a family holiday for me. It's a understanding of perhaps why Israel exists and the history of the Jewish people coming to Israel.
Adding to the religious and cultural mix, Palestinian Muslims attended Friday prayers at the Mosque of Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place in Islam. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Scientists say planting trees can pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, reducing the amount of heat-trapping gas. Major corporations have supported an initiative to plant 100 million trees around the world by 2022. A project in the eastern United States is working to restore forests to the mountains of Appalachia, damaged by many years of surface coal mining. VOA's Steve Barragona has more on this story.
Deep within West Virginia's Monongahela National Forest lies a rare stand of virgin woods.
Living in the East, there's not many places that you can go and be untouched by man.
Shane Jones is a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says a mapping mistake spared these trees when the surrounding forest was logged decades ago. That's good, because red spruce forests like this one excel at taking planet-warming carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and locking it away in the soil.
See all that organic material?
It's black because it's incredibly high in carbon.
The mountains of Appalachia have lost 90% of their red spruce forests to logging and coal mining. Burning that coal for energy is adding more and more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. As the planet warms, scientists say the need for forests to remove that CO2 is increasingly urgent. The University of Kentucky's Chris Barton says tropical rainforests get the most attention.
But here in the temperate region of the world, in Appalachia, 4 hours away from Washington, D.C., we have billions of trees that potentially we could be planting.
Where better, Barton says, than here on the remains of old strip mines? That's one reason Barton started a group called Green Forests Work, to put trees back on the roughly 400,000 hectares of Appalachian forests that have been strip mined away. But there's a problem with many of these lands.
If you went out and planted trees on these sites, they just didn't grow. The ground was way too, you know, compacted. Water didn't infiltrate. Roots can't penetrate. Oxygen can't circulate in those environments.
The solution looks more like a Game of Thrones battleground than a forest in the making. Ripping up the compacted ground will let the trees they plant put down roots. Barton says it's not always easy to convince people it's a good idea.
We've had a lot of people kind of look at us twice. But it's the really interesting thing about it is after we do it, there's no question that that was the right thing to do.
They're starting to see results. Forests are coming back on the grounds they've ripped up and replanted. In West Virginia alone, restoring red spruce to its old habitat could lock up the equivalent of 56 million barrels of oil, scientists say. But not right away. It will take decades. Shane Jones says patience is key.
It's really awesome to see a tree planted 8 years ago that's now waist high. But at the end of the day, at the end of my day, we're barely getting started because our main goal with the restoration work that we do here is to basically take actions to then let nature take over.
Around the world, experts say, nature offers powerful tools to fight climate change. Nature works slowly, they say, but it works. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Elkins, West Virginia.
In the state of Colorado, an award-winning group called Intercambio trains volunteers to teach English as a second language to immigrant students from around the world. volunteers, and their students often become lasting friends, building meaningful connections that help the whole community. From Longmont, Colorado, Shelley Schlender reports.
At the Intercambio Community Center in Longmont, Colorado, Deepa McCauley is teaching immigrants how to talk about health in English.
Running a fever doesn't mean that you're running. Running a fever is the temperature. Yes, exactly. The thermometer moves.
McCauley students come from around the globe. She doesn't have a teaching background, but was trained by Intercambio. Executive Director Lee Shanis says the program is designed to help community volunteers teach language to immigrants.
We created our own training materials because we found that a lot of the materials out there were not directly geared towards volunteer teachers. And we've had 5,000 volunteer teachers since we started, you know, 18 years ago. And volunteers are capable of doing an amazing job, but they also need something ready to go, and also really practical and relevant.
How's he feeling?
Depressed. Depressed.
Oh, my child is depressed.
From discrimination.
Yep. Depression can come from discrimination. My father, in India, he was an engineer. He came to America. He was collecting carts in the grocery store. He was depressed.
Changing life.
Big change in life.
Deepa is awesome. She was, you know, one of our many teachers who had zero experience as a volunteer teaching English when she first came in, and we've seen huge advancements in her quality of teaching and her quality of getting her students engaged.
One of the main reasons I wanted to teach English is because my parents were first-generation immigrants who didn't speak English, and they had a really hard time. And they wouldn't have had a hard time if they had a place like Intercambio. This is a frown. So somebody says, "I see your frown." This is that right there. That's a frown.
My name is Silvia Gonzalez Nava. When I left my country, I didn't speak at all English, at all.
If my grandma only knew Spanish, I wouldn't know what she was saying.
That's why I speak English, because I want to have a good conversation with you.
Her English is getting better.
A lot better.
The volunteer teachers and their students both say the meaningful connections they have at their Intercambio classes build lasting community connections. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Longmont, Colorado.
You want to drink tea, right?
You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Until the stars began to form, the only atoms in the early universe were mostly of hydrogen, some helium, and trace amounts of lithium and beryllium. Scientists theorize that about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, elements of helium and hydrogen atoms formed the first molecule in the universe, helium hydride. While many think the molecule should exist in parts of our universe, it was never detected until recently. In a new study published in the journal Nature, scientists say they were able to detect the signature of the first molecule in the universe in a planetary nebula 3,000 light-years away near the constellation Cygnus. The discovery was made by the scientists who used sophisticated instruments that were aboard NASA's Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, or SOFIA, the world's largest airborne observatory. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition. You can find us online at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington, and be sure to enjoy your day.